As you know, the relationship between quantum mechanics and gauge theories is twofold. On the one hand, we have the program of quantizing gauge theories, and on the other hand, we have what we could call the gaugification of quantum mechanics. That is to say, the tentative to consider quantum mechanics in the light of some formal and conceptual insights coming from gauge theories. Examples of this strategy are Rovelli's relational quantum mechanics or Smolin's relational hidden variable theory. In what follows, I will try to apply to quantum mechanics a fundamental idea coming from gauge theories. Namely, that there exists what I will call a gauge correspondence between properties of physical systems and symmetries generated by these properties. Before starting, it is worth saying that this approach relies strongly on an analysis of the geometric formulations of mechanics, namely the symplectic formulation of quantum mechanics and the quantization formalism known as geometric quantization. So, what is a gauge theory? According to Dirac's definition, a gauge theory is a constrained Hamiltonian system. That is to say, a Hamiltonian system plus a set of first-class constraints. That is to say, a set of functions on the phase space which are in involution, that is to say, which form a closed Poisson algebra. These first-class constraints play a twofold role. On the first hand, they define the constraint surface by means of these equations. This constraint surface is a presymplectic submanifold of the phase space. And on the second hand, they generate gauge transformations. The fact that the constraints are in involution simply means that the orbit generated by one constraint remain in the constraint surface defined by the others, which means that the gauge orbits define a null foliation of the constraint surface. Hence, we can take the quotient of the constraint surface by the gauge orbits, and this quotient defines the reduced phase space of the theory. The observables of the theory are the functions on the reduced phase space, that is to say, the gauge invariant functions on the constraint surface. Instead of working on the reduced phase space, it is generally more convenient to work in the original, in the whole phase space, by fixing the gauge, that is to say, by selecting one representative in each orbit, and by introducing a cohomological algorithm for identifying the observables, namely the so-called BRST cohomology. I will use the following terminology. If a state satisfies the constraint, I will say that the constraint is a property of the state. We can thus state that the attribution of properties strikes twice. First, there is a restriction to the constraint surface, and in the second place, there is a projection to the orbit space defined by the gauge transformations. In other terms, localization to the constraint surface entails the impossibility of localizing along the gauge orbits. That is to say, there is a limit to the complete localization of states. I localize to the constraint surface, but I cannot localize along the gauge orbits. So what is the obstruction to this complete localization or determination of states? In fact, two constraints can be both properties of the same state only if they commute weakly. In fact, this is why it is necessary to ask that they are in involution. The fact that the Poisson bracket of constraints is a combination of the constraints means that the constraints commute on the constraint surface. So we can say that non-commutativity is the obstruction to the attribution of different properties to the same state.
because on the whole space phase they do not commute. But this is to ask that they commute in the whole phase space is too strong. I can simply ask that on the whole phase space they are a combination of the constraints. So automatically this means that they commute on the constraint surface where the physics takes place. Okay, so because the constraints are zero.
So this does mean approximately zero.
No, it means weakly, commute weakly. That means they commute only on the constraint surface. So, non-commutativity is the obstruction to the attribution of different properties to the same state. In other terms, if a constraint is a property of a state, then the state is defined modulo the gauge transformation defined by the constraint. Therefore, functions which are not invariant along the gauge orbit generated by the constraint cannot also be properties of the same state, which simply means that properties have to commute with the constraints. I'm sorry? Yeah, in this case, properties are the constraint, but afterwards I will use observable properties which, in any case, have to commute with the constraint. But in this case, properties are the constraint. Thanks. So again, this imposes a sort of non-commutative limit to the process of determination of the states, in the sense that we can go on attributing properties to the states if and only if the properties commute. So the fact that the observables do not permit to distinguish states belonging to the same orbit does not mean that the theory is incomplete. That is to say, it does not mean that it could exist hypothetical hidden variables that would permit to distinguish gauge equivalent states. That is to say, states belonging to the same gauge orbit. So what is the relevance of all this for quantum mechanics? Again, according to the theory of constraint Hamiltonian system, there exists a correspondence between properties defined by constraints and symmetries defined by gauge transformations, being non-commutativity the obstruction to the attribution of different properties to the same state. And, of course, symmetries reduce the amount of observable information that is necessary for describing a physical system. So, we know, thanks to quantum mechanics, that Q and P cannot be both observables of the same quantum system. So, this is the idea that I want to convey. Maybe the reason for this quantum uncertainty is that we forgot to take the quotient by a remanent quantum symmetry.
I fixed it in your app.
Oh, yeah, thanks.
Is it remnant? It means
residual.
Residual, okay. So I was a little afraid that maybe I mistranslated.
Because what does remnant mean here, written like this?
I don't know.
It's not a word.
I didn't think it was a word, but I thought possibly it was a French word.
Okay.
It's not an English
word. Well, it didn't correct it there. I'm sorry.
So what do you mean by remnant quantum symmetry then?
I mean that if we begin with the constraint of phase space, we can take quotient out all the symmetries and pass to the reduced phase space, which is an unconstrained phase space. So in this unconstrained phase space, according to quantum mechanics, I cannot localize in both Q and P. So what I am proposing is that maybe there is still one residual symmetry, which is not a symmetry coming from constraints.
You're proposing that there's an additional symmetry that is not a symmetry coming from.
Exactly.
Okay.
That it is a symmetry for unconstrained systems.
After which they would come in. The quotient, this further symmetry, then they would come in after that.
No, after that, it will not be possible to localize in both Q and P. Either Q or P will become a gauge coordinate, a coordinate along the gauge orbit.
This is how to generate quantum uncertainty from a classical theory, right?
I'm sorry?
You're taking a classical theory and generating quantum mechanics by modding out by some additional symmetry, which you're calling a quantum symmetry, but it's applied to a classical theory.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's not something that's being done.
I mean, I have the classical theory.
Belong to the same sigma by definition.
I'm sorry?
Yeah. They would never belong to the same sigma by definition. This is what it's saying, right?
What
if you mold out the further quantum symmetries, P and Q,
cannot be both observables of the same system, because one of the coordinates will be gauged out by the this quantum symmetry. Okay, I'm applying the idea coming from gauge theory to an unconstrained phase space, where according to quantum mechanics, I cannot localize Q and P are not both observables. Okay,
yeah.
Is it clear? Because this is the main idea of the whole talk. Okay, so. As I was saying, we will try to generalize from constrained systems the gauge correspondence between properties defined by constraints and symmetry transformations generated by the constraints. To do so, I will now distinguish between the properties given by the constraints, which define the reduced subspace of possible physical state of the theory, and the properties given by the observables. That is to say, by the functions on the reduced phase space, or by the functions on any phase space without constraints. These properties permit us to select one possible solution among all possible physical solutions defined by the constraints. So there are properties which define the subspace of possible physical states, and there are observable properties which permit me to select one state in this space of possible states. So I will claim that the gauge correspondence between properties and symmetries should be valid for both kinds of properties. That is to say, not only for properties coming from constraints, but also for the observable properties. That is to say, any function on an unconstrained phase space. It is worth noting that, of course, this is not the case in classical mechanics, since observable properties do not generate symmetry transformations. In other terms, since any two distinct points in the reduced phase space are supposed to describe states which are physically different, there can be no symmetry acting on an unconstrained phase space in classical mechanics.
For instance, the momentum generates spatial translations, for instance. I mean, that's a common way of speaking, but it seems to...
Yeah, that's the kernel of what I will say. In fact,
okay.
The momentum generates displacement in the position, but I do not interpret these transformations as symmetry transformations.
I see. Okay.
Or the Hamiltonian generate transformations in time, but I am passing from one physical state to another physical state. They are not different representatives of the same physical state. That is to say, in classical mechanics, I cannot pass from active transformations to passive transformations. This Leibniz equivalence is broken.
Right.
Okay? So, in a sense, we will force the validity of the Leibniz equivalence between passive transformations and active transformations in classical mechanics. Okay? So, again, the proposed generalization of the gauge correspondence to unconstrained systems will forbid localization in phase space even if there are no constraints. The remanent quantum symmetry. The residual quantum symmetry that forbids localization in an unconstrained phase space can only be generated by the canonical variables of the reduced phase space. So, another way of presenting the main idea of this talk is that the conceptual justification of the uncertainty principle is somehow encoded in the very definitions of the canonical variables Q and P. So we could say that this is our minimal prescription for trying to understand quantum mechanics. Let's simply try to understand what a momentum is.
You mean in a classical context first?
Yeah. And what is the problem with the classical definition with the momentum in the classical context?
So I see. So one of the points is going to be that we don't understand momentum. Most of us don't understand momentum as deeply as we should in the classical context before moving to the quantum complex.
Yes, in a sense, yes, that is a statement. We'll see why. Okay?
I just wanted to understand the philosophy.
Yeah, but that is the idea. So, if the quantum symmetry does not stem from the existence of constraints, what could be the conceptual motivation for formulating this new symmetry principle? Well, as I have just said, in order to answer, it might be necessary to go back to very basic questions, such as what is mechanics and what is an observable, like a momentum p. The usual relativistic answers to these questions is that mechanics is the study of the evolution of physical systems in time, and that the momentum is somehow related to a velocity, that is to say, to an effective physical motion in the coordinate Q. These answers depend on the existence of a temporal structure, that is to say, of an external parameter T and a conjugated Hamiltonian. Nevertheless, a temporal structure is an additional layer of a structure which is not encoded in the very definition of a symplectic manifold and its canonical variables Q and P. Indeed, a temporal structure can be defined either by introducing an external parameter T and a Hamiltonian function if we are dealing with subsystems of the universe, or by selecting an internal physical clock in a parameterized system with a Hamiltonian constraint if we are working with cosmological solutions of general relativity. Moreover, there are systems, like for instance the gravitational field, which do not have a canonical temporal structure. Hence, the answer to the question what is mechanics and what is an observable like P cannot depend on the presupposition of such a structure. I'm sorry? What I am saying is that you have the symplectic manifold with the canonical coordinates Q and P, and in order to study the evolution of systems in time, I have to add an additional layer of structure, which is the definition of Hamiltonian. Okay? Or if I am working in a constrained theory, I have to fix the gauge and I have to select a physical clock, and I will obtain a temporal structure, what I'm calling a temporal structure. Okay? But the very definition of the canonical coordinate do not depend on such a structure. So, since my question was, what is a momentum, I do not want to presuppose a temporal structure in order to answer this question. That is the idea. Okay? Roughly speaking, I don't want to identify a momentum, I don't want to relate the momentum with velocities. So, in order to answer this question, what is mechanics and what is an observable like a momentum, we can begin by noting that the very definition of physical observables is related to the action of a group on phase space. To show this, we have to take into account that phase space is a symplectic manifold, that is to say, a manifold endowed with a two form, which is closed and non-degenerate, and what this two-form does is to define the correspondence between observables and what I will call classical operators, which are vector fields on the symplectic manifold. And in turn, these classical operators generate symplectic diffeomorphisms of phase space, that is to say, diffeomorphisms that preserve the symplectic structure. This correspondence between observables and classical operators is given by this application. The symplectic form is a kind of antisymmetric metric in the sense that it defines a duality between the cotangent bundle and the tangent bundle. So I can take a function, I can take the differential of an observable and find the corresponding vector field, which is called Hamiltonian vector field. And it is easy to see that this Hamiltonian vector field preserves the symplectic form so that the diffeomorphisms that they generate are symplectic diffeomorphisms.
Could you back up? Could you go back one? So what is the strategy here? It went too fast for me.
What I want to say is I want to generalize the gauge correspondence between properties and symmetries. So now I am asking the question, what is an observable, any function on phase space? So in order to answer this question, I want to stress the fact that an observable in classical mechanics is related to the action of a group on a symplectic manifold. That is to say, the definition of an observable is naturally related with the notion of operators acting on phase space. There is a natural correspondence between observables and operators. Oh, and this is the classical fact.
So an observable is a function on phase space.
Yeah.
And then and by canonical mapping, you can make a vector field on the phase space.
Yes.
And now you want to say that the appropriate notion of observable is not so much the function,
no, I'm
but
saying
rather
that
the action of the vector field.
Now, what I want to say is that in classical mechanics, there is a natural correspondence defined by the symplectic form between observables and operators. And this is the classical fact.
Okay.
Operators are a classical notion. Okay? And these operators act on states and act on other operators by means of the Lie bracket of vector fields. Okay? So again, if I, yes.
Does this apply also to generalize the observables?
Like for instance?
Like the resolution of identities, more or less.
I don't know.
Because of, these are classical observables.
Yeah,
but you can then define a resolution of identities in phase space.
I see.
So like equivalent of a POVM.
Right, so the fuzzy indicator function.
Yes, but these aren't indicator functions at all, are they?
No, these.
So this doesn't even correspond to orthogonal observables. His notion here. So the language they're talking about as an observable is an indicator function. If you were in this region of phase space, you give an answer yes, and if you're not in this region, you say no.
Okay.
And then Luca points out that one can make an idea of a fuzzy indicator function, where it says, if you get this answer, then it means with certain probability you're in this region of phase space. But what you're calling an observable is not necessarily the same thing.
It's a, well, for the moment, it's a differentiable function on phase space, what in classical mechanics we call observable. I don't know.
It will define a set of sharp indicator functions.
Mm.
Just take the regions in phase space that are all assigned the same value by that function. Define a characteristic function over that region, and that's your indicator function. So
does it affect the argument?
I think the answer to Luca's question is that you don't have symmetries associated with fuzzy indicator.
I suppose so. It's because you have you don't have just a single function, but a resolution of the identity. So I don't know exactly how you would associate a vector field to it.
Okay. So, going back again, I want to associate properties with symmetries. So the first step is to show that, in fact, properties given by observables are naturally related with operators, which are generators of transformations. So the next step will be to interpret these transformations as symmetry transformations. Okay? In order to follow what I'm saying.
Sorry, and check. The observable you define, right? Are the one that if I apply a covariant derivative, because your options are a curvature in phase space, right?
Mm.
A curvature. Because if you introduce a gate group, right?
Why then it's a curvature?
Because what you're doing is taking the Poisson bracket, right?
Yeah?
Yes, that's a non zero curve. It's what is quantum mechanics.
Well, yes, what you call curvature is a symplectic form.
Yes. And so when you have to define observable, you have to take the observable, when you apply the covariant derivative unit, it is zero. Right?
Yeah.
But in this case, you can have, for example, a ribbon of ambiguities, you know, can be non zero in a non trivial way. So when you define, you can have a solution to this equation when you introduce a gauge group.
Yes.
You know, sorry. In some cases, you can define an observable. It's not really observable because there is no trivial solution to this equation.
know, you understand what you mean?
Not exactly.
Yes, go ahead, one word.
Maybe afterwards yes, you can explain it to me with
sure
detail. But if I understood what you are calling curvature is given by the symplectic form,
yes.
Which in fact is a true form,
yes.
which measures the non-commutativity of vector fields. In fact, if I put two Hamiltonian vector fields here, I will obtain the Poisson bracket.
Yeah.
Okay. So, in particular, I have shown that observables are naturally related with operators which generate symplectic diffeomorphisms. A particular case of all this is the momentum. And a way of saying it is that the momentum generates canonical transformations of the position through the action of the classical operator associated to the momentum, which is derivative in the position. And if one can define a Hamiltonian of an physical clock, of course the momentum can be related to the velocity through Hamilton's equation. However, what I want to convey is that it is only through the mediation of the Hamiltonian that the canonical transformation generated by T becomes a transformation for the position in time, that is to say, an effective physical motion. If we abstract the existence of a Hamiltonian, we cannot pass from canonical transformations to effective physical motions. In other terms, the intrinsic definition of P as a generator of canonical transformation does not make any reference to temporal processes. So, the natural question is what information about the state is conveyed by P if it is not related to the velocity of an effective physical motion in time? Indeed, if we want to define P as a quantity that generates canonical transformations of the position, there should exist a relationship between the particular value of P and the transformation that it generates. Okay, I am saying that a momentum generates canonical transformations. So now I am asking what is the relationship between the value of the momentum, which is the information about the state, and the canonical transformation that it generates. Again, what information about the canonical transformation is conveyed by a particular value of P? And for the case of the velocity, we know that the particular value of the velocity conveys information about the transformations of the position in time. So in principle, we could expect that the particular value of P also conveys information about some kind of virtual velocity associated to the canonical transformations of the position. However, this is not the case in classical mechanics. In other terms, the canonical transformation of Q generated by P does not depend on the value of P. If I take two different values of P, they define the same transformation of the position. This is a consequence of the fact that the classical correspondence between observables and classical operators is not injective or faithful. If I take any constant function, the associated operator is equal to zero. For any value of K. I'm sorry?
Multiples of P?
Where?
No, if you had a multiple instead of adding a constant function. If P prime equals 2P.
Well, in that case, it will change.
Yeah. Classically.
Yeah. In other terms, the correspondence between the Poisson algebra of observables and the Lie algebra of classical operators is not an isomorphism of Lie algebras, because the correspondence is not injective. It is easy to see that the fact that the canonical transformation generated by the operator associated to P does not depend on the particular value of P because of the fact that VP and VQ commute. In other terms, the commutativity of the classical operators associated to P and Q is the obstruction that prevents us from defining observables as properties that quantify faithfully virtual transformations.
I'm a bit troubled by Steve's point. So you're trying to argue that as I range over the values of P, I get the same canonical transformations. And then you say, well, one way to range over the values of P is to add a constant of arbitrary value and see if the transformations are different for different constants.
Yeah.
But another way to range over the values of p is take whatever, you know, some given value of p and then multiply it by some factor that ranges over all possibilities, and then you'll find that indeed your Poisson bracket does depend on that factor. So that suggests that the strategy of your argument is a bad strategy.
I don't think so, because I'm interested in transformations of p which are generated by the operator associated to q. That's why now I am considering the commutation properties of vp and vq. And vq generates translations in p. I take p and act by means of the classical operator associated to q, and this translates p. So this is the kind of transformation that I'm interested in, transformations generated by vq, which are displacements in p.
I see.
Okay.
So the other transformation would be a scale factor for p, which would be
I think so.
Okay.
Okay. Good. But the fact that p and p prime generate the same canonical transformation is a consequence of the fact that vp and vq commute. That is to say, the Lie bracket is zero.
By p and p prime, or by p, you don't mean a numerical value, you mean a function. And p prime is a function which is...
No, I mean a numerical value.
What does it mean? I mean, how do I transform a numerical value into a vector field? P is a function.
Well, yeah, of course. P is a function, and it's an observable. It's a function of phase space. So I can define its associated classical operator, its associated vector field.
Right.
Okay?
And P prime is a function to which I add a function.
No. Now I am asking, what happens if I fix the value of P? Okay? So what happens with the transformation that the vector field associated to p generates for different values of p?
I don't understand this. I really don't understand mathematically what does this mean. I mean, if I tell you that the momentum is, the value is 3, you can tell me what the vector field is. And so it's a mapping from functions to vector fields, but not to numbers to vector fields. I don't understand that. Can you?
Yeah, but afterwards, I want to use this coordinate to localize states, to say this state is characterized by these values of p and q.
Okay.
So that is to say, in classical mechanics, classical operators play two roles, two different roles. On the first hand, they are functions of phase space, which permit me to localize states. And this state depends on the values of the functions. And on the other hand, they define vector fields, classical operators. So now I'm trying to understand what is the relationship between these two roles. That is what I'm trying to say. And what I...
That's still something that I don't understand. If that's a numerical value, you can always write p plus k as alpha p.
P plus k?
You can always write it as alpha p. And then, but if it's alpha p, then they do not generate the same translations, right? This is what you just said, the common term of skin. Something to understand. How come? I mean, you can always spread p plus k is alpha p.
If p is a numerical value.
If p is a numerical value.
Gabriel, I think you told me the answer to this yesterday. So let me see if I can get it right. Yes, p and q are functions, that's what you're describing. And now they're functions over a phase space manifold. And the question you're asking, so that manifold also has axes. We can label those by q tilde and p tilde. So
yeah.
Q tilde and p tilde are things that take on numerical values. Q and p are functions. And the question you're asking is the vector field at one value of p tilde that's generated by p the same as the vector field at a different value of p tilde generated by p? So you can talk about the value, the nature of the vector field at every point in the phase space.
Yeah.
And you want to know if translations along the p tilde axis changes that vector field.
Yes. Maybe I can...
Does that clarify?
So it's looking at the value of vector fields at different points.
Or at different points on the phase space, yeah. And so the difference between those points is just one of moving along the momentum axis in the phase space.
Okay.
And he's saying the vector field associated with the function momentum is the same at two positions along the momentum axis in the phase space.
So I think this is what we are saying, if I understand. Here I have a vector field defined on the whole phase space, and I want to see how the vector field in one point changes when I change the value of the coordinate. Okay? That's exactly what you are saying.
Because
I want to see how the vector field depends on the value of the point where or the point where I am evaluating it.
But it does depend on the value of the coordinate.
Well, in classical mechanics, no. That is the consequence of the fact that they commute.
Okay, so it doesn't matter whether you write the value of the coordinate as alpha p or p plus k. It just doesn't depend on the value of the coordinate.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go back.
Are you going to present us 266?
No.
20 minutes.
So, if I still wanted to interpret P as a kind of virtual velocity that quantifies faithfully the virtual transformation of the position, we have to force the non-commutativity of the operator associated to Q and P. And we have to provide a physical interpretation of these virtual transformations, which are not physical motions in time. Okay? So, let's summarize what we have done till now. To define the observables of a Gerich theory, one has to take the quotient by Gerich symmetries, and according to quantum mechanics, Q and P cannot be both observables of the same quantum system, so we have proposed the hypothesis according to which maybe there is a remnant quantum symmetry which can only rely on the very definitions of Q and P since there are no constraints. And we want to generalize the Gerich correspondence between constraints and symmetries to the physical observables of unconstrained systems. And in fact, physical observables do generate symplectic diffeomorphisms of phase space, and in particular, P is the generator of canonical transformations of Q. However, the presupposition of a temporal structure leads us naturally to interpret this transformation generated by P in terms of velocities and effective physical motions. So if we abstract this temporal structure, the fact remains that P generates transformations of Q that could be interpreted as symmetry transformations and not as active transformations. The problems that we have encountered are that the fact that BQ and BP commute prevent us from interpreting P as a kind of virtual velocity that quantifies faithfully the virtual transformation of Q. In other terms, the particular value of P does not convey any information about the canonical transformation generated by P, which is another way of saying that the vector field does not depend on the point. And in the second place, we do not know what the physical meaning of these virtual transformations would be. In order to solve these two problems, I will propose two postulates. The first one, the quantum postulate, will permit us to provide a timeless definition of P as a quantity that quantifies faithfully the virtual transformations of Q. And the Gerich postulate will provide a physical interpretation of these virtual transformations. In order to introduce this postulate, I will first present, in rough terms, the ontology of physical objects that stems from these postulates. And in a sense, we could say that this ontology matches to a certain extent an intuitive phenomenological conception about objects.
Yeah. If you carried on this program, you had this quantum and Gerich postulate, but then would they have to be compatible with the fact that when we introduce a Hamiltonian, then we can interpret P as something that has anything to do with the motion, or you are saying that they could be not compatible, and then we have to change the Hamilton equation?
No, I think everything will be compatible. But what we will say will have consequence on the temporal structure. That is to say, what we will say will have consequence of the temporal structure that we can define on this, but nothing will change at the level of equations. This is an interpretation, a conceptual framework. I will not.
So there will be no.
Contradictions with what we know from temporal Hamiltonian mechanics. Yeah. That's why I'm using the word abstract. I'm going to make abstraction of the fact that there is a Hamiltonian. But there is a Hamiltonian. But I don't want to go too fast from momentum to momentum to velocities. That is the idea. Okay?
The fact that you have positions and momenta is just because your basic equations are from second order classical physics. So you need your initial conditions. Your space is just a space of initial conditions.
Yeah.
If you had a third order equation, you would have positions, momenta, something else. So you can't completely abstract from the temporal structure, because your phase space could be completely different, like three kinds of quantities instead of two, and so on.
Yes. Well, we could say that if I am working in a parameterized system, the reduced phase space will depend on the flow that I have chosen. So in the sense, the unconstrained space depends on the temporal structure that I define. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, the fact that you have position and momenta, and not position, momenta, and something else. It's just because your equations of motion, classical physics, are second order. So you need.
I don't think so. I have position and momenta because phase space is an eclectic manifold which has two kinds of coordinates by definition. And there is no.
But he says not by tradition, by Newton's laws, effectively.
Yeah, the phase space came about because Newton's law requires a given set of initial conditions, which are a position and a derivative of the position, because they are second order. That's your phase space. It's the phase space. It's the space of initial conditions for your equation of motion.
Yeah, of course. That's a symplectic geometry was inspired by mechanics. But what I am saying, let's try to leave the Hamiltonian for. Let's make abstraction of the existence of Hamiltonian for a while, okay?
Okay.
And let's try to see if I can provide a definition of P which is not related to the transformation to the position in time. Okay? Because I want to interpret the transformation generated by P as a symmetric transformation. That's why I want to put aside the ineffective physical motion in time. Okay?
Okay.
So what I was saying is that I will propose these postulates, and in a sense, these postulates formalize an intuitive definition of what an object is, a physical object. So what is an object? An object is a physical configuration that has different faces, aspects, or profiles, such that the different faces are related by means of certain phase transformations, of transformation that I will define as phase transformations. I have an object, I can rotate it, I can observe its different phases, and the transformations which permit me to do this will be called phase transformations. And an object is defined by a set of objective properties that permit us to identify and recognize the object in spite of the variations of its faces. Okay? These are the three components of the definition of an object. Of course, this means that the objective properties must be, by definition, invariant under phase transformations. Okay? To summarize, we could say that there is no objective entity without an invariant identity given by the objective properties, nor without different phenomenological phases. I want to stress that the notion of phase transformation is not directly related to temporal processes, and it defines a universal notion of invariance, which stems from the very notion of a generic object, that is to say, independent of the particular symmetries that it may have. Indeed, we can say that phase transformations arise from the fact that any physical system is, independent of its particular symmetries, a multifaceted object, an object
with a sheaf of faces. I want to stress that the fact that the face is not by definition an objective property because it is not invariant under phase transformation does not mean that different faces cannot be distinguished. For instance, the different numbers of a die permit us to distinguish different non-objective faces. This is why the toss of a die can produce different results. So it's a particular kind of notion of symmetry. It doesn't mean that the object is invariant, that I perform the symmetry and I see the same, but it means that there is a certain subset of properties which are the objective properties which are invariant, okay, under phase transformations.
So you have a very particular use of objectives. So suppose I roll a die and it ends up with a 6 on the top. And most people in common language would say the 6 on the top is an objective property. And I know it is because I hand it over to the person beside me and I ask her, look, and she says 6. And I hand it to him and he says 6. But that's not the usage you give to the word objective.
No, but in a sense, this is not weird. I'm just defining objectivity as invariance under a set of transformations. This is a classical definition. I'm adding nothing new to that definition.
Whereas what one might think of the number 6 as a contingent property. It didn't have to be. It could have been a 2. And so it seems like what you're trying to capture with the word non-objective is better mapped to the English word non-contingent.
Maybe.
I think that the difference, because your observers are already agreeing on what is top. He's just saying that the number you say sees, it depends on what you look at. I mean, if you look at, from one point of view, you see it for one number. If you look at the other side, you see another number.
Yeah, and it's important to
so this is not an objective quality of the dice. What face you see, because it depends on who.
But it's a property of the die. That is why it is not the same that on one face there is a 6 and there is a 20. The fact that on one face there is a 6 is a kind of property of the die which is not objective. It's a face. So it's not a symmetry in the sense that, for example, if I have a sphere and if I rotate the sphere, I always see the same. In the case of the die, I do not see the same. The number will change. But it's not objective in the sense that I am using the word objective. Any object has two kinds of properties, objective properties and faces, which are also properties of the object.
Okay?
So
faces are a property of the object and the perspective of looking at it.
Of course.
So it's a function of two entities. So your faces in first speak would be a perspectival property.
So the problem is that then they're not properties of the object itself, the properties of the object and the context. So I think I don't know how important it is, but somebody might argue that they're not subjective or non-objective properties of the object at all. They're just not the properties of a joint of an object with respect to some external.
Yeah, for example, I could put one die within another die. And in that case, the fact that the faces have different numbers, we define relative faces which will have physical effects. And in fact, this is the reason for the
observable character of relative faces in quantum mechanics, at least to. So
there is a physical. There can be physical consequences of the fact that not all faces have the same number. Okay, so it's a property of the object, which can have physical effects. Even if it is not an objective property in the precise sense that I am using. Okay?
Given what you said in this discussion, it seems to me that terminology that might be appropriate here would be that what you're calling objective properties are what philosophers call intrinsic properties, and phases are extrinsic properties. So extrinsic properties are things that don't depend just on the object itself, but things outside it. So the perspective, would be part of the extrinsic property, whereas the things that are determined just from the object alone are the intrinsic properties.
So maybe the terminology is not the the best one. I choose the word phase because it's related to phase transformations and to phase space, so, and it's related to the phases of a die, so it's a word which has a whole shift of meanings which I can use. But maybe it's not the best election. Yes. Hello.
Could you just define it equal to invariant? I mean, you more or less your definition, isn't it? Objective is invariant.
Objective is invariant under phase transformation.
Yeah, I mean, you could just get rid of the word objective and just say invariant.
Yeah, of course.
Make people happy.
Yeah, of course. I can say the invariant under phase transformations. Yeah. Thanks. That would be a more economical solution from a terminological point of view. Okay? Do we go on? So I will now introduce the two postulates. The first one states that the correspondence between observables and operator has to be an isomorphism of the algebras, which implies in particular that the operators associated to Q and P no longer commute. And this postulate guarantees what I wanted, that is to say that the particular value of an objective property P, of a property P, quantifies faithfully as a kind of virtual velocity the corresponding virtual transformation of Q. And this is exactly what happens in quantum mechanics, of course, because I am imposing a part of quantum mechanics. For instance, if I have the values of the vertical angular momentum of this quantum object specified faithfully, how the object transforms differently under the same rotation, under the same universal rotation. Okay, I have the same universal rotation, but these two objects transform differently. And it is the value of the objective property, vertical angular momentum, that specifies faithfully how this object transforms under the same universal rotation. So the problem now is to interpret in physical terms these virtual transformations. If I have said, they cannot be understood as effective physical motions in time. So in order to answer, I will use this gauge postulate, which says that the transformations generated by an objective property are nothing but phase transformations of the system. This postulate extends to the very definition of the canonical variables Q and P of unconstrained systems, the gauge correspondent between constraints and symmetries. This generalization depends on a universal concept of symmetry, which is valid for any object. In part, that is to say, symmetry is associated to phase transformations. This postulate clarifies the fact that the momentum is not related to the transformations of the position in time, but rather to the timeless intrinsic structure of the object, that is to say, to the fact that any object is a superposition of phases.
What do you mean by superposition of phases?
I'm sorry?
The fact, so this sentence, the fact that any object is a superposition of phases.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Well, it means if I can define a die as a superposition of phases. Okay? I have many faces and I superpose to form an structure which is a die.
So do you mean by this a collection or a set? Or do you mean?
I mean a superposition.
Superposition in quantum mechanics usually means addition of two vectors.
Yeah, that's why.
You don't mean that.
Yeah, I mean that. But I mean exactly that. I mean, I'm trying to interpret this quantum superposition in terms of this ontology of objects. And I would say that the quantum superposition can be understood as the superposition of the phases of a die. Okay?
And superposition of phases of a die means what?
Well, it's nothing but if you want a visual
scheme. You don't mean multiplication by a scalar and addition, you mean something else.
I don't understand the questions.
When you say the superposition of
faces
of a die, I think of forming kets with numbers in them and then multiplying them by complex numbers and adding. But you don't mean that.
Well, I am moving from an intuitive realm of What
I want to understand is the intuitive realm. What are you trying to convey intuitively with this language?
I am trying to say that an object can be understood as a superposition of faces. And an object is defined by a set of objective properties which are invariant under the phase transformation that interchanges the faces. Okay? And afterwards I will try to transport this model to quantum mechanics. And I will understand the quantum object as a superposition of faces, where the superposition is the addition of quantum states. Maybe if I go farther, it will be clear, and afterwards we can go back.
Can I rephrase Chris's question? You don't have to answer it now, but you said that you'd like to give an interpretation of quantum superposition.
Yes.
I see that as saying, right, we have a mathematical notion of superposition, which is linear combination with complex coefficients of vectors in a Hilbert space.
Yes.
And you want to replace that mathematical definition with a physical one involving physical concepts.
Yes.
And you can't just throw in the word superposition and say, oh, the physical interpretation is physical superposition. You have to define what superposition is. So I haven't yet heard what a definition of that physical notion that's associated with linear combination would be. You just keep throwing the word superposition in there. Superposition of phases, where phases are physical things. But what do you mean by a superposition of phases? If phases aren't vectors, then you have to tell me what that means.
What I mean is that the terms of the superposition cannot be objective properties of the object. In the same way as the numbers on the faces of a die are not objective properties of a die. So what I mean by superposition is simply the idea that each term of a superposition cannot be, by definition, an objective property of the object, but only a non-objective phase, which of course can be the result of a toast. Okay?
What if I said like a disjunction or a conjunction of phases? That's also a set of phases which can't be, which we're denying objective significance to. So that would be presumably saying, I think the content is what it means to say superposition. So you have some sort of collection and some operation on the collection. So a disjunction is an operation. Superposition might be thought of as some sort of operation.
Yes.
I'm not sure. I think maybe that's the direction. That's how I understand the question, and I'm not sure I understand the answer either. So I think everybody understands the point about what the phases are not, you know, objective properties.
Yeah.
It's the superposition of phases. So you don't usually talk about the collection of the faces of a die, not the superposition.
Well, but because I think that the visual image of a die conveys the correct interpretation of the quantum superposition. The idea that in a quantum superposition, the different terms of the superposition cannot be considered objective properties of the object. Exactly as in the example of the die, the different phases of the superposition are only phases of the die, but not objective properties.
Let's come for the die, I would think of it this way. You would say the objective property of the die is made mathematical by the set, with a set with cardinality 6,
yes.
A set of numbers 1 through 6, and the group of permutations on that set. And that represents the objective properties of the die. Is that correct?
No. They are non-objective by definition.
No, the whole collection. Not the... The whole collection plus the permutation group.
No, we'll see what are the objective properties. But it's not the whole collection. The whole collection is the object. It's not the objective properties that define the object.
The whole collection is the object.
Yeah. The whole superposition of the set of faces is the object.
Now you use superposition again, which confuses me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So you mean the is there anything in the world of superposition more than the set or the outcomes or this phase?
One way of asking that question is, at this intuitive level, when you say superposition, do you imagine there are many different possible superpositions, or is it just a word to remind us that there are many different phases?
No, in fact, there will be many, 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 many different weights of the compose an object as a superposition of faces. that from that point, the image of the die is not more useless. It becomes useless. Okay? I don't know if...
So I think I understand. If you have a vector that's an eigenstate of an observable f, and it's not an eigenstate of an observable g, therefore it's a superposition of eigenstates of an observable g, then I think of the eigenvalues of f as objective properties,
yes,
and I think of the eigenvectors of g as spaces.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's right. You wanted to ask something?
No, I think that it was already superseded by the previous.
Okay. So now I am adding an additional idea by means of this Gaussian postulate, which is the following. The usual definition of objectivity as invariant under a set of transformations depend on the set of transformations that I am using. Of course, if I change the group of transformations, the invariant will change. Okay? What I am saying by means of this phase postulate is that the phase transformations that define the invariants are generated by the objective properties themselves. Okay? I am saying that the transformations generated by an objective property are phase transformations of the system. So we'll see immediately what are the consequences of this.
Sorry.
Well, of course, this is what happens in quantum mechanics, no? This is what you were saying. If P1 is an objective property of this object, okay, then the object is defined modulo the phase transformation generated by the corresponding operator. So the idea is that Heisenberg uncertainty principle is a direct consequence of the circular imbrication established by the Gaussian postulate between phases and objective properties. As I have said, objective properties of an object must be, by definition, invariant under phase transformations. And afterwards, the Gaussian postulate states that the objective properties generate these very phase transformations. Okay? Therefore, an objective property has to be invariant under the phase transformation generated by the whole set of objective properties of the object. Okay? An objective property is an invariant under what? An invariant under the transformation generated by the objective properties. It's a circular definition. Okay? For example, if F and G are objective properties of the object, then they have to satisfy this relation. That is to say, F has to be invariant under the phase transformation generated by G, and vice versa. Hence, the set of objective properties of an object has to define a commutative Poisson algebra. And this is a consequence of the Gaussian postulate, of the idea that the objective properties of the object generate the phase transformations which define them as invariants. In particular, if the momentum is an objective property of an object, then the position is necessarily like the phase of a die, a phase with no objective value. Well, this is, do I have someone? It's okay?
If you could wrap up quickly, though.
Okay, so I will skip these two postulates in the framework of geometric quantization are implemented in two different stages, which are the prequantization of the symplectic manifold and the introduction, the definition of a polarization, but I will skip this. So, the notion of phase permits us to understand how it can be the case that the result of measurement can be a non-objective phase of the object. Indeed, as I have said, the superposition principle acquires an implicit meaning in the sense that an object is nothing but a superposition of phases. We could say that Einstein was literally right in the sense that quantum objects are like dice. That is to say, configurations with different phases that can be tossed. In particular, it is meaningless to ask what the objective position Q of an object with a well-defined momentum P is. It is worth noting that this quantum ontology entails a commitment to what we could call an intrinsic relationalism, in the sense that the very fact that an object is a superposition of non-objective faces permits us to define its invariant properties as the relational differences between its faces. This relational character of quantum mechanics does not stem from the extrinsic relation between different objects, but rather from the intrinsic relations between the different faces of a single object. So we can now say that the objective properties of a die are the relational and faithful generators of the transformations between its different faces. That is to say, an object like a die has a set of non-objective faces, but there are generators, relational generators of the transformation between these faces, and these generators are the objective properties of the object. So I will just say some words about the fact that this interpretation suggests in a certain way a particular comprehension of quantum probabilities, in the sense that we could say that the distribution probability that specifies the probability of obtaining tail or head when throwing a coin might be understood neither as a description of the instantaneous state or the temporal evolution of the coin, nor as a consequence of our subjective lack of knowledge of its deterministic trajectory, nor as a property of an ensemble of coins, but rather as a faithful description of the intrinsic structure of a single coin. That is to say, of the fact that the coin is a single multifaceted object with two similar faces. In the same way, we could say that quantum probabilities could be considered objective in the sense that they convey information about the intrinsic multifaceted structure of single dice-like objects that can be tossed.
Can I ask a question on this coin? Are you saying that if you flip a coin, you think of it as somehow a mixture of heads and tails and some, I mean, we're talking about classical probability here.
Yes.
So you're saying it doesn't really have a particular orientation, it's neither heads up nor tails up, until you look at it, for example, but it's some sort of a superposition in some classical sense.
Yes.
Heads and tails.
Yes. In a sense, what I am saying is that if I ask you, give me a description of the coin, and you give me a distribution probability, this distribution probability conveys information about the objective structure of the coin.
That's objectively what the coin.
That's what I'm calling objective. Yes. So there is an information about the objective structure of the coin as a multifaceted object conveyed by the probability, the quantum probabilities. This is an intuitive idea that I have to. Well, do I have time to summarize what we have done in 3 slides? Or if not, I will repeat things that they have just said. So if you want, I can stop here.
Just stop now and open up for questions.
Okay. So thanks for the attention.
Questions? Yes.
I'm going to take a leap here and use a whole bunch of words that.
I'm sorry?
I'm going to take a leap here and use a whole bunch of words so that it will become clear I don't understand. But to the extent that I understand anything, it seems to me that once you look further than just superposition, but actually it's something like Bell's inequalities and states like that, what quantum mechanics tells us is that particles don't have any particular intrinsic and multifaceted structure, right? You can't say that a particular particle has a particular set of is made up of a particular set of phases, because if you look at the difference and nothing is clear, then different things will come up. Does that make any sense at all, or possibly not?
I think so, yes.
So
what is the question?
Well, the question is, how does this help? Let's understand the intrinsic non-locality, or whatever you want to call it. It's encoded in Bell's theorem.
Maybe one consequence of this idea is that, in a sense, quantum mechanics is, a main conclusion of all this is that quantum mechanics is complete in the sense that it describes all the objective properties of any physical system. That is a particular statement, an important statement that we can derive from this conceptual framework. Let's say that the fact that Q and P cannot be both observed, that in phase space, in a sense, or classical state, in a sense, are overdetermined because they include not only the objective properties, but also non-objective ones. So it is not the case that quantum mechanics is incomplete, but rather that classical mechanics is overdetermined because there is not a clear demarcation line between what the objective properties and the non-objective phases. And I cannot do that in classical mechanics because the classical notion of an operator is not satisfactory. So I cannot impose this ontology in classical mechanics because the formal structure of classical mechanics does not permit me to do so. Okay?
How do you, because the, usually the meaning that saying that it is incomplete is just the fact that in classical mechanics, if I give you initial states, you can always give me sharp predictions, no statistics, no probabilities. In quantum mechanics, you cannot. So that's why you say it's incomplete. If I could give you some more information, I could give you also exact predictions.
Yes.
So how this relates to what you said up to now?
Well, I think that the fact that I would answer by means of the following comparison. In gauge theories, there were people who thought at the beginning that, in fact, the fact that we cannot localize physical state along a gauge orbit is because there is something missing. That the different elements of a gauge orbit are physically different. But the theory does not allow me to say where is the system. Okay? And afterwards, they realize that, in fact, they are all different representatives of the same physical state. So there is nothing missing. What there is acting is a symmetry. It's a symmetry principle, which reduces the number of relevant variables. So am I using the same argument for justifying the transition from classical to quantum mechanics? Okay? In classical mechanics, there are too many variables because there is a symmetry acting on classical space that we have not taken into account, and which is a symmetry that is generated by the very definition of the canonical variables, because P is nothing but the generator of a symmetry transformation of the position. So that's why I think that these ideas go against the kind of hidden variable theory. The idea that we can localize even further, it's like saying that we can localize a physical state in a gauge orbit. I don't know if this is clear.
Yeah, but in that case, the classical case, okay, you discovered that what you think were, what you thought were different states, it's just one state. But still, you have sharp predictions. You don't have a statistic, or you don't need to use probability.
Yes.
But in quantum mechanics, probability appears.
Yes. Yes. I think, I'm not sure. I'm not sure of what is the answer. But I think that the problem, one possible way of trying to find an answer is that the notion of gauge symmetry and the notion of phase symmetry or phase transformation are not exactly the same because of what I said at the beginning, the fact that the different phases of an object, even if they are not objective, they are properties of the object. And in classical gauge theories, one of the reasons that justify the identification of different states in a gauge orbit is that if I do not do that, the theory becomes undeterministic, because the theory does not predict what is the state along the gauge orbit. Okay? But in quantum mechanics, it's an speculative idea. I have the probabilities of the statistical character of quantum mechanics stems from the fact that, in fact, when I produce an experiment, I obtain a result which is an element of a gauge or of a phase orbit. Okay?
In the classical case, it doesn't make any sense to give different probabilities. You have no, since they are just, you're thinking about the same things, but you're giving them different names. So it makes no sense to give them different probabilities. But in quantum mechanics, it does. So.
No, if I accept in classical mechanics, in gauge theories, that the different representatives of a gauge orbit are physically different, then the theory becomes indeterministic. OK?
In the sense that you
can. Yeah, non-deterministic.
Which theory becomes non-deterministic?
Gauge theories. If I do not accept Leibniz equivalence, if I do not accept that the different elements of a gauge orbit are physically equivalent, because the theory does not predict where the system will be along the gauge orbit. So if I impose the idea that the different elements are physically different, then the theory does not predict where the system will go. So I have to impose Leibniz equivalence, and I have to identify all the states of the gauge orbit. So I get rid of the indeterminism.
But that's the point. In the classical case, you don't have any grounds in your theory. You don't have any mathematical means or physical means to give different probabilities to the what you thought were different states. So you have no mathematical physical mean to say, I think this is with 75%, and this state is 25%, even if in reality there's the same thing. In quantum mechanics, you can't do that.
Yeah.
And there are this difference in probability assignments as different physical means. So that's why I don't understand in which way then you can identify them.
Well,
in classical case, because you're, in this case, you have a symmetry you don't see. For example, if I put a potential on a line, right? And they forget that there is a potential, and they look at the points on a line, you will find, for example, if I take a head, that will be more in the center. Also, in classical case, you can think to it. But if you forget that there is a potential, I don't know.
Maybe a different one. Can I ask it this way? How do you get the Born rule out of this?
Yeah.
The Born rule.
Well, in fact, I didn't have an answer for his question. That's what I have just said is only an idea for going further, but I haven't developed that. So I have it's the same question. I don't know.
It's supposed
question.
To be the same question.
Yeah. Right? So yeah. I don't have an answer for that.
Yeah. Okay.
There's a question.
Why don't you go ahead?
Thank you. It's very. I'm a bit confused. What happens if you consider a quantum state and instead of P and Q, another pair of non-commutative observables? Would you repeat the whole all sentence and say that they do not commute because there is some additional symmetry that we didn't consider? So I don't understand to what extent what you're saying is specific of Q and P or over any pair of.
Well, let's say that any classical system is given by means of a surface space, which is a symplectic manifold, and they are always symplectic coordinates. Which so, if I am quantized in a classical space, I would be given coordinates on the symplectic manifold. That can I call Q and P. That is an essential feature of any symplectic classical system.
Non-commuting observables A and B, would you still say that one of the two is not an object property?
Yeah, of course. It's exactly the same as the theories. If you have a constraint, any property, even if it is not canonically conjugate, which does not commute with a constraint, cannot be an observable. I mean, the definition of an observable in gauge theory.
But imagine that you are already in the gauge invariant Hilbert space, okay? But you can still have two operators that do not commute.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So would it mean that one of the two is not an objective? So how would you explain the fact that they do not commute? But you still pose the same problem that they do not commute, so you cannot have simultaneously the value of both, right? So one of the two is not an objective.
Well, it depends.
I don't see what that is to do with the fact that you're on the physical interspace or on the total interspace. Because you can decompose the problem. Once you are in the gauge environment interspace, you can still take two observables and one for me. And then you can repeat, or, yeah, you know, maybe that this is not the gauge environment interspace. There's some other gauge symmetry that have to gauge away until I have just one observable or all the observables that commute.
I don't
it seems that you're saying that every time you have two operators that do not commute, this implies that we are on an Hilbert space that is too big.
No. What it means is that the two operators cannot be both sharp objective properties of the same system. So either one is objective and the other is completely phased out, or either both are unsharp objective properties.
It's the same thing that Rob was suggesting before, I think. You're calling objective property something which corresponds to an eigen, an observable for which the state of the system is an eigenvalue of that observable.
Yes.
That's what you're calling it. So what's an objective property depends on the state, on the state vector. Is that right?
Of course, yes.
And that's the more general question I wanted to ask you. When you say that the description, the quantum description of reality is complete, of course, it doesn't say what is the quantum description of the system. Not all of us agree on what that should be. But I take it that in your point of view, the quantum description of the system is the state vector. Neither more nor less.
Yes. The state vector is a complete description of the state of the system, the objective state of the system.
And then, of course, the question that people call the measurement problem comes in. So if the interpretation is supposed to shed light on that, sort of the most important problem in many people's mind is this measurement problem.
Yes.
Are you saying that you don't have something in answer to some of the other questions, that you don't have an answer to that within this
Not for the moment, no.
Is this helping us to reformulate the problem, or?
I cannot say it, but I don't know. That's what I want to do. But for the moment, I started, instead of attacking these kind of problems directly, I began from another point of view, and now I want to go towards these kind of problems. But for the moment, I don't have an answer for that. The only thing that I can say is that the fact that a measurement gives a definite output does not mean that this output is an objective property of the system. It's exactly like the image of a die. If I toss a die, I obtain a number, and this number does. The fact that I obtain a number has nothing to do with the fact that this number is an objective property that characterizes the object. It's only a non-objective phase.
Once the measurement is complete, in the standard viewpoint, the system is in an eigenstate of that
objective.
Are you calling that into question? I mean, why are you saying that result is not an objective property? Let's say after the measurement takes place.
Well, that is the problem of the collapse. I don't know. I can give for the moment only very fuzzy answers. But I would say that one of the properties of quantum systems is like in set theory, where a set is a collection of sets, no? And in the difference between a quantum die and an ordinary die is that the faces of a quantum die are quantum objects. Okay? That is to say, a quantum superposition is a superposition of quantum objects. Okay? So I think the collapse in these terms, if you throw a die, what you obtain is another die with which you can go on playing. So that is the intuitive idea that I have in mind, but it's only an intuitive idea. The fact that an object is a superposition of object has the consequence that if I dot the object, afterwards I can go on playing with the result that I have obtained, because the result that I have obtained is an object, it's another die.
Maybe we should stop with questions here, and then we can just ask them. Or Chris, do you have a brief question? We can ask it afterwards, right? Okay, let's thank Gabrielle again.